DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
In this edition, demanding political change, how Cambodia's exiled opposition is staging a comeback. Cities of the future, how urban developers are planning for expanding cities, and the many challenges facing the mayor of Monrovia, and why she's still optimistic. Stay tuned. Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn, Germany. Cambodians living in exile in Europe rallied to demand political change in their home country this past weekend in Paris. Such protests against Prime Minister Hun Sen, who has ruled Cambodia for more than 30 years, are becoming louder. But it's difficult to voice discontent inside the country, where the government is cracking down on critics and freedom of speech in the lead-up to the general elections in July. Last November, the Prime Minister dissolved the only real opposition party, the Cambodia National Rescue Party, or CNRP, and banned more than 100 politicians. Chris Janssens reports about the situation in Cambodia and the political opposition.
People of all classes in the country understand very well the goal of this Cambodian National Rescue Movement. One day we will decide to tell the people to stand up, and they will stand up.
Sam Rainsy speaks before an audience of about 200 Cambodian expats on a rainy day in Marne-la-Vallée on the outskirts of Paris. The charismatic former leader of Cambodia's opposition lives in self-imposed exile in France, and he's just launched a new political movement with the support of the German Social Democratic and Liberal Democratic parties. This new movement has a very clear goal.
The main goal is to liberate all political prisoners, starting with the president of the CNRP, Mr. Kem Sokha, who is in jail. Prime Minister Hun Sen is afraid of real elections. That's why he abolished our party. This, in fact, is a sign of weakness. He doesn't dare face his opponents in a free and democratic vote.
Prime Minister Hun Sen came to power in the mid-1980s in the aftermath of the Khmer Rouge regime. A few years later, in 1993, Cambodia held its first free election under the supervision of the United Nations. But critics say the process of democratization has been hampered by Hun Sen from the very beginning. Human rights groups have described him as a dictator who has sought to eliminate political opponents and maintain his grip on power through violence and intimidation. During a recent crackdown, journalists were arrested, newspapers shut down, and activists threatened. Kem Sokha, the president of the opposition Cambodian National Rescue Party, was jailed in September, accused of plotting a coup, charges which he says were politically motivated. Then, in November, things escalated. On that particular Thursday morning, the Supreme Court dissolved the CNRP at the request of Hun Sen's government. The leaders were said to be guilty of conspiracy. Protesting against this decision was impossible, as police officers and soldiers had cordoned off an area of 1 square kilometer around the courthouse. By late afternoon, the decision was made. The Cambodia National Rescue Party had been officially abolished. And so the ruling Cambodian People's Party, the CPP, eliminated its only viable opposition ahead of the next general election in July. The CNRP was founded in 2012 by Sam Rainsy and Kem Sokha. They won a significant number of seats during the 2013 national election, and several CNRP members came to power in local elections last June. One of them is Tachavut. She lives in the village of Araiksat, around 50 minutes by boat from Phnom Penh. The government has ordered CNRP politicians to step down or defect to the CPP, but Tachavut doesn't plan to go anywhere.
I'm not intimidated. There were enough people who voted for me. Let them be angry on my behalf.
The people I speak to in this small town say they plan to keep supporting their leader, but some seem more committed than others.
She can't just go to CPP. That would be dishonest to the people. She has no choice but to leave.
I don't really care about politics. The most important thing for me is to have food in my stomach. I live day to day and sell my stuff here.
There is another reason why Cambodians will not protest so easily. They are afraid. I am in Takeo in Cambodian's southwest with Pauk Se, an 80-year-old woman. She's the mother of Kam Lei, a political journalist who was shot and killed in 2016.
When I heard the news, I did nothing. I was too shocked.
Every day she sits next to her son's grave. There are huge portraits of him and even a statue, but also a painting and pictures taken just after the killing. You see his body covered in blood.
I still don't understand why they killed him like that.
Officially, Kam Lei was murdered over a debt. The shooter is behind bars. But was this a political murder? Kam Ritisit, younger brother and companion of the journalist, doesn't give a clear answer.
I cannot say which specific party killed him, but the public knows who was holding the gun. It was the government.
And then a representative of the government walks towards us. Pok Sambo has been a village chief for 20 years and he is related to Kam Lei.
We grew up together. We went to school together. We worked in the rice fields. I feel sorrow for the loss of Mr. Kam Lei.
This village chief belongs to CPP, the prime minister's ruling party. He won't accuse his own party of murder, but admits the government didn't make enough of an effort to find the real motive behind the killing.
I don't believe that the government was not able to find the real killer.
I talked to people at the Takeo marketplace and I realized the murder of Kam Lei was a turning point.
The government lost a lot of dignity and credit because of Mr. Kam Lei's killing.
Talking about politics is difficult, but I do hear the word change very often.
The rich quickly become richer and richer, but the poor are getting poorer and poorer.
It's time to wake up and fight.
Further to the south lies Kampot, where Australian expert Julian Paulson organizes a literature festival each year. He says he's concerned about the government's crackdown on freedom of speech.
We're certainly well aware of big changes here. Cambodia's losing its independent voices, and when the dialogue stops, everything socially becomes more restricted and complex and difficult. And we've also felt the pressure of the media crackdown here.
Back in Paris, Sam Rainsy is about to finish his speech.
Thank you all. Let Hun Sen live his destiny. He is playing a personal game because he clings to power. He will go on killing people and destroying his own country. He is selling big parts of Cambodia's territory and its natural resources. If you go on like this, Hun Sen, you will soon be finished. I, Sam Rainsy, am ready to lead this movement to save the country.
Can these exiled politicians actually change their country from a distance? France, and by extension the European Union, does have the power to put Hun Sen under pressure, says André Gattolin, a French politician and member of President Emmanuel Macron's République en Marche party.
Cambodia, Laos and a certain number of other less developed countries are benefiting from the Everything But Arms agreement. This means they can export all products except weapons, in Cambodia's case it's mostly textiles, to the European market without restrictions and without extra taxes. We must suspend this system, not in order to harm the Cambodian people, but in order to harm those in the inner circle of Prime Minister Hun Sen, who are benefiting from, or should I say abusing, this economic system.
But will Hun Sen be intimidated by economic sanctions? China is currently investing billions of dollars in Cambodia without asking questions about human rights. Sam Rainsy is firm on this issue.
It's not China or Russia that gives a country democratic legitimacy. Only democratic countries can do that, like the European Union or the United States. The free world should make Hun Sen understand that elections without an opposition party are not legitimate. In politics, you don't predict the future, you create it.
For DW, I am Chris Janssens.
How can our cities become more sustainable and ready for a rapid influx of people? That's a question experts from around the world are currently discussing at the World Urban Forum in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Cities 2030, Cities for All is the motto of the conference. Helle Jeppesen talked to several city planners about the cities of the future. Neil King has her report.
Today, more than 50% of the world's population of 7.6 billion lives in cities. By 2030, that number is expected to top 60%, according to the United Nations. But the world's megacities are already reaching their limits, and it's the mid-sized cities with populations of up to 5 million which will see the biggest influx. Ifa Dick, an urban expert with the German Development Institute, doesn't think these cities are ready to absorb the onslaught.
No, they won't be able to. The infrastructure still needs to be built to serve these extra people.
These crucial investments will create millions of jobs, which will in turn attract even more people to cities. But just who should finance this infrastructure development? According to Wolfgang Scholz of the Faculty of Spatial Planning at Dortmund University, the private sector is eager to invest.
Private investors are looking for an investment that will bring in returns over the long term. Infrastructure projects, of course, are grateful for the financial boost because people depend on these services. And anyone who decides to back a water supply network, for example, won't have to worry about a competitor building up a second supply network. In a sense, we are creating monopolies.
But Scholz, an expert on urban planning and infrastructure, especially in the Southern Hemisphere, warns against the dangers of privatization.
The liberalization of the water market in the 1990s, an idea proposed by the World Bank in some African and Asian cities, has generally led to a deterioration of the water supply. And then the municipalities had to spend a lot of money to get the water systems back.
Für sehr viel Geld wieder vom Staat zurückgekauft werden.
What then are cities desperate to replace their crumbling infrastructure to do? Most cities have little or no tax revenue to contribute to infrastructure investment. That's usually controlled by the state. But Scholz says there have been some success stories. Tanzania, for example.
Man hat jetzt gesagt, ihr Städte bekommt das Geld.
There, the government said the cities would receive the funds, but they had to prove they could provide the necessary services. If local governments were able to prove they properly managed these services, they were given more authority to make decisions.
Mehr Kompetenzen zugewiesen.
Huge investments are still needed to meet the demand for sustainable urban development. This week, city and government representatives are meeting with researchers, business people and civil society representatives at the World Urban Forum in Kuala Lumpur to discuss how sustainable development can be realized.
A sustainable city meets social, economic and ecological requirements. It's inclusive, productive and environmentally friendly.
Today, cities are responsible for around three-quarters of global CO2 emissions. Around 80% of the world's gross national product is generated by cities. But resource consumption by cities is just as high. To make our urban homes more sustainable, Dick says modern technology is a must, be it in the energy sector, water supply, transport networks or information and communication technologies. Around the world, so-called smart cities are being planned to take advantage of everything these technologies have to offer. In October 2016, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman announced his city of the future, NEOM, to be built on the shores of the Red Sea. Billed as the most modern city in the world, it would be a liberal enclave with its own taxes and laws and a source of well-paying jobs for Saudi Arabia's fast-growing educated population. Menial work would largely be done by robots, with digital networking playing a central role. It aims to follow the model of the Songo, a district southwest of Seoul that provides a high-tech 24-hour networked home to around 100,000 well-off people. But these cities of the future have their detractors.
Das sehe ich nicht als eine nachhaltige Alternative an.
I don't see this kind of smart city as a sustainable alternative, because that becomes almost a ghetto where only the rich live together, sealing themselves off from ordinary people.
Stefan Schmitz is an urban planner and architect in the city of Cologne. Since 2012, he's been responsible for planning a new development in Mongolia, Maidar City. Situated near the Mongolian capital, Ulaanbaatar, and intended to ease the housing pressure on the city of nearly 1.5 million, Maidar City is being planned with ecology in mind.
You can't just buy a piece of land and do whatever you want. There are very specific rules, especially when it comes to ecological construction and the use of renewable energy.
His vision, however, goes far beyond environmental sustainability. In his plans, Maidar City will not just have one city centre. Instead, it will have many neighbourhoods with their own focal points, each providing jobs and housing, cultural offerings and public services. This, says Schmitz, is how livable cities should be built, not as luxury ghettos or gated communities for the wealthy.
A city can only be sustainable when it's mixed, both socially and functionally.
That was a report by Helle Jeppesen, presented by Neil King. A smart city, that's a faraway dream for Monrovia, the capital of Liberia in West Africa, where many of the 1.5 million inhabitants don't even have clean water. Many people fled to the city during the years of the Civil War, and more than a decade later, improving infrastructure to cater for all is still a massive challenge. When the current mayor, Clara Domvogo, was appointed, she had big plans to improve particularly the health and sanitation situation quickly. But shortly after she took office, Ebola broke out in neighboring countries and also threatened Monrovia. When I caught up with Mvogo in Bonn recently, she told me about the challenges of being the mayor of Monrovia and how the pandemic changed everything.
It surprised all of us. Ebola wasn't something. You know, every year we have cholera outbreak sometimes, we have dysentery outbreak, all these other things. But Ebola was a different beast. It really took us by surprise. I became the mayor in 2013, November, and Ebola arrived in March 2014. So all the plans had to go out the window, and you had to concentrate on just awareness, making people aware of it first, accepting it, because people were in denial. They didn't believe it existed. They thought it was something the government made up to attract sympathetic money from outsiders. So it really was a hard sell to the general population.
In addition to having the psychological problem persuading people this is really a major crisis, you also had so many other impediments. Access to water, access to electricity is very limited still. I think only 10% of your population has access to electricity.
Yeah, and at that time, we still hadn't the hydro, which is on now, had not come on board. So people were using generators in like about 95% of the homes. We have a lot of informal settlements, which you would call slums. We have about 20 of them in the city of Monrovia. Many of them are on the coastal area. So these people were like living their own world, not part of what you call central Monrovia. And you had to reach out there to them and inform them that their personal hygiene had to change. Public toilets needed to be built, which was one of the priorities I had before Ebola struck. And we had started working on building more public toilets in these informal settlements. Our country have an illiteracy rate of about 75%. So you had to educate people in another way than you would have just putting it on the radio and television. You had to go door to door to educate people. So this is where I think we learned the best lessons during Ebola about community involvement, because it was the leaders in the communities that helped us to get rid of Ebola. It wasn't the government. It wasn't me as the mayor. It wasn't the international organizations, even though they contributed funds. But had these people not listened to their own community leaders that this thing is real, we would still have been fighting a losing battle.
You said you had already started programs to improve the sanitation system, to improve water access and so on. What's the situation now for people in your city? Have things improved?
Well, Ebola taught us a lesson. Our healthcare system was not ready to handle it. So now we have the government working with the international organization to put in place healthcare systems that can prevent. We have now an actual public health service. We have the Ministry of Health, but now we have a different bureau that handles just preventative issues. And that's very good. Electricity has come on board in the last 2 years with the turning on our hydro system. So the city is lit up a little better, and the water system is back in place in many areas, but we still have a shortage of public toilets. We still have a shortage of clean drinking water in many of the communities in and around Monrovia. So that's an ongoing process.
But you also have, of course, a lot of challenges, given that you just emerged from like 2.5 decades of war and fighting. And even I think the center of Monrovia was destroyed prior to 2003. And the city had to kind of rebuild itself completely. So do you think there's more hopelessness or more a spirit of resistance?
We've had 14 years of peace. People in the city of Monrovia are very resilient. And we are bouncing back. People are building homes. The roads are being improved by the government. The schools are increasing. Clinics are increasing. So the years of war we are trying to put behind us. We are trying to move forward.
All across Africa, there's a big, huge unemployment. So do you have the same problems, and how do you solve them?
We have the same problem, and I'm not sure if we are able to solve it easily until we can reach the point where we start to create jobs outside the city. We do have a population explosion in Monrovia because when the war happened, people left the rural parts of the country to come into the city to avoid being attacked by the rebels and all of that. They didn't go back. Many of them stayed. Monrovia was established for like about 500,000 residents around 1980 when the first coup happened. Today we have 1.5 million people. So that's three times the amount of people for a city, we haven't caught up in terms of social services. The schools we are trying, the clinics we are trying, the roads we are trying, but it's going to take some creative way of looking at creating jobs outside Monrovia in a rural area to make people go back to, like, say, farming so that we can depopulate the city a little bit and then give people a better standard of living.
That's the mayor of Monrovia, Clara Ndom-Vogo, and she'll be talking about how her background in psychology helps when dealing with people still marred by the trauma of violence and war, and why it can be an advantage for a mayor to be an old lady, after this short bit of music. This is World in Progress, and I'm Anke Rasper, talking to Clara Ndom-Vogo, the mayor of Liberia's capital, Monrovia.
You just spoke of the spirit of resilience that there is in your town in Monrovia, and the whole country has seen so much trauma, so much killing, problems, fear, and all that. With your background as a psychologist, do you see there's this particular way that people in your country deal with trauma?
I think one of the things most countries coming out of war miss, we miss the opportunity to address the trauma people were exposed to. So they get angry quickly, they're ready to fight at any time, and so you have to be of the temperament that you understand it. I try to sometimes put myself in their position because being traumatized is not an easy thing. I lived through the 1980 coup. I was in Liberia when it happened, when the soldiers were running around with guns and chasing people. I was held at gunpoint myself. So I know what it feels like to be traumatized. So when you're talking to people, you try not to also want to make them even angrier than they are because of circumstances you don't understand. You don't know where they came from that day. And here you are trying to make them want to change their minds to do things differently in the city. And as the mayor of Monrovia, fortunately for me, I try to keep that in my mind sometimes when dealing with certain situations. I think what we need to do in Liberia today is to be able to have counseling, both in the schools and communities. People need to be able to go someplace safe to talk and express themselves. I think the first thing we're looking at in terms of healing in Liberia, well, let's get the kids back in school. Let's build roads. Let's make sure we have electricity. Let's make sure we have water. You know, and now is the time for us to say, let's put a little bit more into that. I think we can do it.
I heard that you did not exactly say, hello, I would like to be the mayor, but you were appointed to this job. Why on earth did you take it on? It's such a huge challenge.
Like all things, people sometimes don't realize what they're getting into until you get in there. I'm a person who likes challenges. And the mayor before me did a great job. So when she left, I thought I could just piggyback on it and continue. And then I realized every day there are more and more people coming into the city. The population 4 years ago, we've added probably at least 5 to 10% more. And most of them are not people who can work in the formal sector, but they're our residents.
You have a tradition of strong women leaders in your country. Do you think it helps that you're a woman and also a woman who's already in her 60s, who has seen a lot of the world?
I'm so glad you say a woman in her 60s. I'm past the 60s. But I've seen a lot of the world. And you wake up every morning and you say to yourself, this is another day. I know I will see challenges. They will write articles about you and you just have to brush it off sometimes. But you have to be focused. I think sometimes the motherly air helps, okay? And you don't have to be one who is forceful. You have to be able to know when to use a stern face, and you have to know when to use a sweet little grandmotherly face. And it works both ways. And so as a result of that, I think I have the advantage of having people, especially the young people, they tend to listen to me. Every now and then, I put on the jeans and the T-shirt, and I drive around town. And people are surprised. They say, oh, that's the mayor. And then I wave to them and say, yeah, that's me. And so even if I'm there to do a bad job on somebody running them off the sidewalk where they shouldn't be, other people will be laughing and say, you go, girl. And so that helps. I mean, you know, it gives them the image that you are human and you're not just this person with authority riding a big car and giving order to people. I get out there with the young kids and we clean the city together. So it helps. I try to connect with the young people because I know they're the ones who are going to have to do it in the future.
That was Clarando Mvogo, the mayor of Liberia's capital, Monrovia. And that wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. You can listen back to this and other editions of the show and to individual reports at dw.com/worldinprogress. You can also download the podcast from iTunes or SoundCloud. For more globalization stories, check out DW Global Society on Facebook. World in Progress will be back next week, and one of our topics then will be the situation of refugees in the Central African Republic. Until then, on behalf of our DW studio team here in Bonn, Germany, I'm Anke Raspa. Thanks for listening and take care.